So it's a sentence which 20 years ago, perhaps 10 years ago even, wouldn't have been recognisable to most people. I'm in the wrong body. Still, I guess it's not something you hear every day, but certainly it's on our radar now, isn't it? This very extreme sense of misplacement that I, whatever I may mean, have been placed in the wrong physical shell, as it were, the wrong outer packaging with the wrong chromosomes and the wrong sex organs. And as we're all aware, then, there's a powerful lobby that encourages this sense of misplacement and encourages a drastic medical interference in response to it. And as Bible-believing people, then, we lament this. And indeed, as Bible-believing people, we commend the Roman Catholic Church for the stand that in these past few days it took against it. But you'll be glad to know I don't intend to preach this morning on the transgender issue. What I do want to flag up this morning, however, is a sense of misplacement that's less extreme and more widely experienced than that one that I've just mentioned. Not I'm in the wrong body, but rather I'm in the wrong situation. I'm in the wrong location. I'm in the wrong job. I'm in the wrong marriage. And this is a major issue. This is a major problem in my life. I'm going to call it situational restlessness. That is, being restless with your general situation. I think it's common, and I think you find it among Christians as well as non-Christians. And I want to try this morning then to bring some biblical perspective to it. Now, the problem with trying to do that is that situational restlessness wasn't such a feature of Bible times. As one writer puts it, back then, if you were the child of a sheep herder, you were going to be a sheep herder. Your calling in life was to keep the sheep alive and to get enough food to last the winter and for your father to arrange a marriage with a nearby person you could make kids with. This whole concept of reaching your 20s and having to suddenly find your calling is a brand new idea in society. It's a modern first world problem. And that being so, situational restlessness is not the first topic that comes into a biblical writer's head when he sits down to pen a psalm or a proverb or an epistle. These authors, they felt the need to address sexual immorality, and they felt the need to address idolatry, and they felt the need to address fears about death, and they felt the need to address all kinds of things, but they didn't feel the need to address this attitude, I'm in the wrong situation. But there's one exception to that. It's Paul writing to the church in Corinth. And as you know, particularly in the first letter to the Corinthians, he addresses a bewildering array of different issues: division, triumphalism, sexual immorality, participation in pagan worship, abuse of the Lord's Supper, a distorted approach to spiritual gifts, denial of bodily resurrection. If there was an undesirable perspective to be entertained on something, if there was an undesirable behavior to be practiced, you could pretty much bet on the Corinthians falling into it. And that even includes then this issue of situational restlessness. For all its modern first world feel, a version of it existed amongst these Christians, and Paul turns his attention to it then here in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 17 to 24. And from what he says in these verses, I just want to highlight three problems with it. Three problems with this particular sense of misplacement, this situational restlessness, as I'm calling it. Three problems that I hope the Holy Spirit will bring home to you this morning if you've slipped into this attitude, I'm in the wrong situation. Problem number one then, it's untrue. It's untrue. You are not in the wrong situation. Now, there are, of course, obvious exceptions to that. A Christian who's earning his or her living as a prostitute, or as a con man, or in some other intrinsically immoral occupation, that person is in the wrong situation. a Christian who's still in the same-sex marriage, so-called, that he or she was in when converted, is in the wrong situation. An unmarried Christian who since conversion hasn't ended his or her cohabitation with a partner is in the wrong situation. I think on the basis of Hebrews 10:25, you could make a case that a Christian who moves somewhere where there's no accessible gospel church, and it's not because he or she is a pioneer missionary, it's simply because the place is scenic or because a lovely big house is affordable there, that person is in the wrong situation. So there are those exceptions then where your situation clearly goes against what the Bible requires. But in all other cases, I'm saying, it's untrue. Living in that place that you live in, doing that job that you are doing, being in that marriage that you are in, however unfulfilling it may feel to you, you are not in the wrong situation. And the reason I can say that is this: our life situations simply aren't important enough to warrant such a grave conclusion as I'm in the wrong situation. They aren't substantial enough for that. Now, that's open to misunderstanding, so let me explain. I don't mean by that the only bit of life that matters is the so-called spiritual stuff, worship and Bible study and evangelism and that kind of thing, and that God isn't really interested in anything else. He isn't interested in architecture and commerce and education and engineering and agriculture and law and medicine and arts. He's just this single-issue deity who finds our Monday to Saturday arrangements utterly boring and inconsequential. I don't mean that for 1 minute. I believe passionately that every single aspect of life is an avenue by which we can bring praise and we can bring glory to God. So in that sense, our life situations are hugely important. But the point I'm making is that when you start differentiating between this location or this job that is wrong for me and this other location or this other job that I must absolutely get and I must absolutely chase after, then you're investing a particular life situation with way too much importance. It's a bit like clothes. So some of you men will, if you have a wife, or perhaps even more so if you have a daughter of a certain age, you'll have had the experience of standing at the front door of your house, car keys in hand, ready to go to some event or other. And eventually she comes downstairs, having spent a good while getting ready. But then in the hallway, she passes the mirror and stops suddenly looking horrified and says, "No, it isn't right. I'm in the wrong clothes." And she dashes back upstairs again. And at that moment, of course, you roll your eyes and you say as patiently as you can, "How can you possibly be in the wrong clothes? Clothes are just clothes. What does it matter?" Now, of course, in saying clothes are just clothes, you're not denying that in one sense clothes are very important. They're important for warmth and they're important for decency and so on. But your point is that it's ludicrous to attach such significance to one particular outfit, one particular dress and cardigan combination or whatever it might be, that until that's put on, every other outfit is wrong. Clothes just don't have that sort of importance. And that's my point then about our life situations. And it's my point because it's Paul's point here in this passage. And in that connection, he says two notable things. Number one, he says your situation is not a part of your identity. Your situation is not a part of your identity. So in verse 22, he does something very striking. He first of all addresses the slaves in the Corinthian congregation, and he says to them, "You guys are free." And he then turns and addresses the free men and women in the Corinthian congregation, and he says, "You guys are slaves." And you think, what on earth is he doing here? Is he just being contrary? Well, no, he's not being contrary. Rather, he's pointing these folk to the deepest realities about themselves. He's pointing them to their true identity, because their true identity resides in what Christ has done for them. And Christ has done two things for them. He has liberated them from the grip of Satan and sin, and he has subjected them to his own dominion and lordship. That is, he has made them free, and he has made them slaves. It's the same for every Christian, isn't it? Every Christian has experienced that paradoxical dual action at conversion, liberation and subjection. We are, all of us, by definition, free slaves, if you like. Or if you prefer it, enslaved free men and free women. And Paul is saying to these Corinthians then, that's what you are. At the deepest level of all, that's what you are. You are these free slaves, these enslaved free men and women. And whatever you happen to be within your circumstances today doesn't alter that one little bit. You might be a highly successful entrepreneur at the very top of Corinthian society who has never spent a day of your life at anyone else's beck and call. It doesn't diminish the enslaved aspect of your true identity. Or you might be the most servile dog's body in some Corinthian household, never having so much as a single moment that you can call your own. It doesn't diminish the liberated aspect of your true identity. Your true identity, he's saying, is this fixed, unalterable thing rooted in the accomplishments of Jesus Christ. Your situation in life is not a part of that. Your situation in life does not remotely impinge on it. And the same is true for us this morning then. That job that you presently have, which you feel so strongly you need to be out of, it isn't somehow making you less. And that other job that you feel so strongly you need to have instead, it isn't somehow making you more. You are complete now. You are a justified, spirit-filled, new creation bound child of God. Your present job or location or whatever does not and cannot affect that, and cannot therefore be this deeply wrong situation that you're thinking it is. You're overestimating it. You're ascribing to it more significance than it actually has. So your situation is not a part of your identity. And then the second notable thing Paul says is this: your situation is not a criterion in God's thinking. Your situation is not a criterion in God's thinking. So a criterion then is a means of assessing something or someone. So a member of the Conservative Party might say that when it comes to voting for a new leader, my criterion is whether the candidate will take us out of Europe with no deal, if that's necessary. In other words, the person is saying, that's how I assess the candidates. That's what I'm interested in. That's what I'm looking out for. And what is God looking out for as he views our lives this morning as his people? Well, verse 19 could not be clearer, could it? Keeping the commandments of God. That's what he's looking out for. That's his great criterion. Not what your life situation is, but rather how you are conducting yourself within that life situation, whatever it might be. That is, he looks on you with pleasure this morning, not because of the job you've chosen, but because in that job you are being honest and you are being hardworking and you are being considerate toward others. Or alternatively, he looks on you with concern this morning, not because of the job you have chosen, but because in that job you are being dishonest, or you are being slack, or you are being inconsiderate toward others. And if then you are fussing greatly today about needing to change your circumstances, you're out of touch with God's mindset. You're fussing about something that he's not bothered about. It's your sanctification, not your situation, that he's bothered about. Your situation is not a criterion in God's thinking. So I hope you get this first point this morning then. And it was on this that I wanted to spend longest. This idea that you're in the wrong situation, it's untrue. And you need to tell yourself that then. Whenever this situational restlessness rears its head. By the way, verse 23 is interesting. There Paul says, you were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. Now, he can't mean there, don't become slaves in the literal social economic sense, because that would undermine his whole argument in this passage, that it doesn't matter what your circumstances are. If it doesn't matter what your circumstances are, then why must they avoid becoming slaves? Now, I think rather he's indicating here that this I'm in the wrong situation attitude was being encouraged among the Corinthians by certain influential people. Perhaps there were teachers coming to the Corinthian church and saying to the slaves in the congregation, you need to get out of your slavery. If you want to be proper, fruitful Christians living a full Christian life, then you need to get out of your slavery. And Paul then is saying in this passage, number one, that's not the case. You don't need to get out of your slavery in order to live a fruitful and God-glorifying Christian life. And number two, here in verse 23, I think he's saying, actually, if you allow that thinking to take hold of you, I can't be a proper Christian as long as I'm a slave. Ironically, you will become a slave of those teachers' ideas. Christ has given you the freedom to be a slave. He's given you the freedom to be in any life situation, including slavery. Don't relinquish that freedom and meekly comply with these teachers who are telling you you can't be a slave and a Christian. And I think the I'm in the wrong situation can still actually be irresponsibly encouraged sometimes by influential people within the evangelical church. I think of the material one reads on evangelism these days, and it'll talk about, you know, having barbecues in your garden every summer to get to know your neighbours and getting involved in activities in the local community centre. And there's no recognition then that a Christian might live on a 12th floor flat in a high rise with no possibility of holding a summer barbecue. Or that a Christian might live in an estate where the local community centre was burned down by vandals about 15 years ago and has never been touched since. And I'm not being pedantic here. The point is that there's this assumption in that material that normal Christians belong to a certain class and live a certain type of lifestyle. And were the Christian living in the high rise or the Christian living in the estate where the community centre was burnt down 15 years ago to encounter that material on evangelism, they might well feel, well, I must be in the wrong situation then. I need to get out somehow of this situation I'm in. Because proper, fruitful Christians, they're able to have barbecues in their garden and go to the local community centre for lots of activities. And I'm saying then, whether the situational restlessness is being generated from within us, or whether perhaps it's coming from other Christians outside of us, we need to be clear, I'm in the wrong situation is untrue. It's untrue. But then secondly, notice with me, it's unhelpful. It's unhelpful. Remember how Ecclesiastes 9 verse 10 says so memorably, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. So God's people then are meant to be fully engaged in life. I often emphasize, because the New Testament often emphasizes, that as Christians we are waiting people. And that's true, of course. We are waiting for the end. We are waiting for Christ to return. We're waiting for the new world that is to come. The unbeliever says, I must get the most out of this life because it's the only life I've got. I must live for the moment. We, on the other hand, we don't say that because we're looking forward to something, the return of Christ and the world to come. But it's also important to say that looking forward to the return of Christ and the world to come doesn't make us disengaged in the present. As we look forward ardently to the future, we also fully fulfill our responsibilities in our families, in our workplaces, in our churches, and we do it, as Ecclesiastes says, with all our might. And the problem then, or another problem with situational restlessness, is that it hinders that. It gets in the way of that. It's unhelpful when it comes to this business of fully engaging and fully fulfilling our responsibilities today. It has the tendency, this restlessness, to disengage us from what's going on now and from what I could and should be doing now. And Paul then flags up this problem in a couple of ways in one verse, and it's verse 21. And so he begins verse 21, were you a slave when called? So again here, he's addressing the slaves in the Corinthian congregation, and it's not difficult for us to imagine, is it, that they more than most must have been susceptible to this situational restlessness. And he says then two things there in verse 21. First of all, he says, do not be concerned about it. You're a slave, a Christian slave. Do not be concerned about it. And so he seems to envisage there a scenario where a Christian slave in Corinth is going about his tasks every day, and he's kind of under this cloud. There's this nagging concern, to use the word that Paul uses, in his head, constantly eating away at him, a preoccupation, if you like. I shouldn't be doing this. I shouldn't be doing this. I need to get out. I need to get into some other type of situation where I can be more fruitful and I can be a more normal, full-orbed Christian. And there's this preoccupation just constantly there, nagging away all the time. And so Paul says, don't be concerned. Don't let concern sap your energy and turn you into a half-hearted slave who no longer brings glory and pleasure to God by your diligent approach to your daily tasks. And so, just by that command then, do not be concerned. There, I think, Paul is implicitly flagging up this potential unhelpfulness, that situational restlessness, it can fill you with just a constant concern, a preoccupation that distracts you from getting on with things. And then, secondly, there's the next part of the sentence, which the ESV, you'll notice, puts in brackets. Now, a bit like what I said a moment ago about verse 23, as it stands, the second half of verse 21 looks like Paul temporarily gets cold feet with his argument. I mean, his argument is it's fine for you to be a slave, and you can be a full-orbed disciple of Jesus as a slave. That's his main argument, but here he seems to kind of get cold feet for a moment and partially retract that and say, well, actually, if you can, then do stop being a slave. But the verse can be translated in such a way that it actually gives the opposite meaning to that, and I think that is preferable in the context. The main issue that you need to be aware of in terms of the the original Greek form of this sentence is that the verb at the end doesn't have an object. So when Paul says, avail yourself, or perhaps better, make the most of, he doesn't actually tell us, or tell them, what to make the most of. He just leaves it hanging, make the most of. The ESV assumes he's talking about the opportunity to become free, make the most of that. But Paul doesn't say that. He just says, make the most. And then the other thing to note is that the verb translated you can, at the start, if you can gain your freedom, the verb translated you can, it's really the verb to be possible. That's the literal verb here. And so that leaves us then with but, or perhaps even if there's a possibility for you to gain your freedom, make the most. And in the context, it seems to me much more likely then that what he's saying is, make the most of each day now while you're still a slave. Now, it isn't that Paul here is forbidding them to stop being slaves. That's not the point. Probably he has in mind a Corinthian slave. And for that guy to become free, to gain his freedom from slavery, it will be far from straightforward. It will be a complicated and a lengthy process. But that guy knows of another guy in Corinth to whom it's happened. And there's this other guy, and he has managed to gain his freedom. And that's kind of given the first guy hope. Well, one day maybe I'll be able to gain my freedom as well. And Paul is saying then here in the second half of verse 21, okay, yes, it does happen. It might be a possibility. It might be a possibility out there somewhere that you could gain your freedom. But don't let that possibility kind of become this fantasy constantly hanging over you and preoccupying you and filling your mind. Rather, make the most of your present situation. That's still just a distant possibility. Yeah, it might happen one day. But don't let that stop you making the most of now and the responsibility to and the potential of glorifying God today in your present still enslaved situation. That's the point Paul is making. And so in those two ways then, in verse 21, I'm saying Paul flags up the unhelpfulness of this restlessness that we're talking about today. And again, it applies to us. Now, by the way, I should just underline something that I touched on a moment ago there. In this whole passage, Paul is not prohibiting changing your situation. And that's important as well. Of course, he is in some cases. If in the marriage example, he is prohibiting changing your circumstances. But when it's your job, when it's your location, of course, you are free to change your situation. And I should also say in that connection that verse 17, I think, comes across, unfortunately, in the ESV. Let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him. Now, that seems to encourage this idea that kind of we all have a vocation, we all have a particular life calling that God has given. And that can then lead to a sort of caricatured Calvinism whereby, you know, you can't possibly change your situation. God has appointed that you should be a plumber. God has appointed you should be a teacher. You can't countenance the idea of ever doing anything else. But that's not what Paul means. The calling to which Paul refers there is salvation calling. God calling you to Christ at the inception of your Christian life. And his point then is whatever situation you were in when you were called to Christ, unless there's good reason to just carry on doing that, you can carry on doing that and glorify God. That's the point Paul is making. So the problem here isn't actually changing your situation. The problem is this restlessness where you're convinced you're in the wrong situation, and when it becomes then an unhelpful and distracting preoccupation. And it does then, doesn't it? it can do. This kind of restlessness, I'm in the wrong situation, I need to be doing something else or living somewhere else, it can put Christians in a kind of limbo for months or years of their lives. Perhaps you've experienced moving to a new area and you rent a property before you buy a property. And because you know you're just renting that first property, you don't kind of really unpack all your things, and you don't really make it your home in the fullest sense. And metaphorically, we can do that, can't we? We can be kind of detached from daily life because we're set on a different situation that we hope one day, sooner or later, will come about. And so at work, we just kind of go through the ritual and we do the minimum, and we don't really consider it my true job. At church, we don't get too involved in other people's lives because it's not really my true church. I hope to be in another place before too long, in a different church. And our lives kind of go on hold for periods of time. And Paul is saying, and don't let that happen. Don't let yourself become preoccupied and distracted and disengaged. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. Wherever you are now, whatever you're doing now, whatever your present situation, do that with your might. Fully engage. Throw yourself in. So this restlessness, it's untrue. It's unhelpful. And then thirdly and finally, it's unnecessary. It's unnecessary. Because you might be sitting there this morning thinking, well, that's all very well, but if you knew my situation. You know, my situation is so difficult. Well, in response to that, I think it would be worth just noting what the situations are of the people Paul is writing to. I suppose I've preached this sermon kind of the wrong way around. We would normally do that context stuff at the beginning, but I'm coming to it now. What are the situations that Paul is talking about here? What are the situations that he's telling the Corinthians not to worry about and just to get on with? Well, there are three, aren't there? Kind of two in the main passage we're looking at, one in the verses before that I read earlier on in the service. So there's circumcision, uncircumcision. That's in verses 18 and 19. That might seem a bit of a strange one to us, but and of course there are letters in the New Testament where you have Gentile believers who are being made to think that if they are going to be proper Christians, they have to get circumcised, and only then can they be real Christians, and Paul has to write against that tendency. I don't think that's a danger here in Corinth. In Corinth, it would have been a predominantly Gentile congregation. And it may be then that it's some of the Jewish believers in this church who just felt a bit left out and might have been tempted to think, if only we were Gentiles like everyone else in this church. It's a Gentile church, effectively. I mean, even this letter, it deals with so many issues that would have been fairly irrelevant to the Jewish believers. I mean, they weren't tempted to go and eat in pagan temples in Corinth. And they wouldn't have been denying bodily resurrection either. So a lot of church life in Corinth doubtless just felt very Gentile, and perhaps some of the Jewish believers might have felt almost like second-class citizens. And if only we weren't circumcised, if only we weren't Jews, then we could be more part of this and we could have a fuller Christian life. So that's one. And then another situation is marriage, and that's in verses 12 to 16. So there were some believers who had been converted, but their spouse hadn't been converted. And for them then, it was tempting to think, well, I could be so much more fruitful if I wasn't in this marriage, married to someone who is not a Christian. And some of you here this morning know something of that. And know how hard that is. And of course, for these Christians, their unbelieving spouse wouldn't have been kind of vaguely Christianized in a cultural way. But their unbelieving spouse would probably still have been going to the idol temples and getting up to all sorts of horrible things there every day. And it was hard then to be a Christian in a marriage to that person. But Paul still says, carry on. You're not in the wrong situation. Stay married. And then, of course, the most striking of the three examples is slaves that we've talked about already. And we can't begin to imagine what it was like being a first century slave in Corinth. And having no freedom and no personal possessions. You didn't clock in at 9 and clock out at 5. 24/7, you were at the beck and call of your master. Surely if ever there was a situation that's going to be wrong for a Christian to be in, and that surely Paul is going to say, yeah, if you want to be a fruitful Christian, you better do something else. It would be this. But no, carry on. You're not in the wrong situation. And so Paul wants these Corinthians to be remainers, not in a Brexit sense, nor even in the sense that I talked about 2 weeks ago, John 15, remain in me. But remain in your situation. As we've said, they do have Christian freedom to move into a different situation. But Paul's point is, don't have this strong conviction you're in the wrong situation, and don't succumb to a preoccupation with the wrongness of your present situation. Remain. You're fine. Just get on with it. A few years ago at the Aberystwyth conference, Dale Ralph Davis was the preacher, and in one of his talks he told a story which he had gotten from one of Faith Cook's books, one of her books with little kind of potted biographies in them. And I found the story very striking, very moving. But I suppose I have a bit of a suspicious mind and always concerned that these stories have been romanticized somewhat. And so I actually went and bought the diaries of this woman that the story is about to check out all the details. And fair play to Faith Cook, she got it all right. And this woman then was called Christian Watt, and she was a 19th century woman living in a fishing village on the east coast of Scotland. And she had 10 children by the time she was in her late 30s. And one of her sons died through tetanus. Another died through an accident at sea. And then, most crushingly of all, her husband was lost one night in a terrible storm when he was out fishing. And eventually, through all of these circumstances, this woman, Christian Watt, she had a breakdown, and she spent some time in an asylum in Aberdeen, and it was during that time that she became a Christian and became a believer in Jesus Christ. And then eventually she went back to the fishing village, but had this terrible stigma then that she'd been in the asylum and nobody would have anything to do with her, and she'd always been gutting the fish with knives. They wouldn't let her touch knives anymore because of her past. And eventually she had another breakdown, and she went back into the asylum in Aberdeen, and she spent the rest of her life there. And the striking thing was then that in that mental hospital in Aberdeen, she became effectively a member of the staff, an unofficial member of the staff. She would work in the kitchen every day there, and she would help with the laundry there. And when new patients came, she would immediately befriend them and comfort them and tell them about the Saviour. And there she was in the grimmest possible situation, and yet no chafing against it, no restlessness, no, I can't be a fruitful Christian here. But if I'm called to work in the kitchen, work with the laundry in this grim place in Aberdeen here, that's what I'm going to do to the maximum, to the glory of God. And that's what Paul is saying here, isn't it? You might be a slave, but you can be a fruitful, full-orbed Christian. And so can you this morning, whatever your situation. The situation you're in right now is the one you're in right now. And in that situation, you can bring glory and pleasure to your Heavenly Master. You don't need to be doing something else, living somewhere else, in a different marriage. But where you are now, you can bring honour and glory to God. Wonderful, isn't it, how Paul ends the passage? Brothers, in whatever condition each was called, there let him remain with God. With God. It's a strong preposition. A para church organisation is an organisation that works alongside the church, alongside God. He's saying to you slaves in Corinth, working away 24 hours a day, scrubbing floors, cleaning toilets, whatever you might be doing, God is alongside you in that context. God is there. God is with you. And you are pleasing him by the way you do it. May he encourage us with these thoughts. Amen.